introduce Judy W. My pleasure tonight to introduce Judy W. from, and she has a story of recovery, which I think is going to be very interesting. Judy, it's all yours.
Well, good evening, everybody. This is my first time at your meeting, and I feel like I'm in good company. Seems most of the meetings I go to, the people are about half my age instead of my age. So I won't spend a whole lot of time on telling you what it used to be like, although I have a lot of time. Most of the time they say, could you tell your story in 15 minutes? And well, that's a little hard to pack that many years in such a short period of time. But anyway, I was the second oldest of seven children. I thought I lived in a very normal home. Working mother and dad, but I realized young, nobody told me this, but I could see that my mother had way too much to do, so I figured I had to be her helper. And somewhere I got the idea that I should know how to do everything without ever being taught. So luckily I was kind of a quick learner, quick starter, but I didn't go in for the long haul. I wasn't at at my best. I remember always being introduced as, oh, what a nice big girl. And I certainly didn't like the sounds of that, although they could have said, oh, what a nice fat big girl. But they said, what a nice big girl. And I happened to be in a class in school where there were about five teeny petite little blonde haired, curly haired little girls, and here I am, and I felt like a klutz with straight black hair, freckles, buck teeth, and the biggest one in the class. So I thought, well, if I can't be the prettiest, then I'll be the smartest. So I did well in school, and by the time I was almost out of grade school, I had put on so much weight that my mother was cutting down her dresses and aunt's dresses so that I could fit into them. So remarkably, between grade school and high school, that summer, I suddenly changed my focus, and I lost all my weight that summer, and I kind of turned from food to booze and boys. So I started drinking at a really young age, and my teenage years were kind of a Jekyll and Hyde situation. I was a overachiever in school, and then at night I was out running around with a wild bunch of kids, and it's a miracle that I'm still alive with all the risky things that I did as a teenager. I met my first husband when I was in college. And, you know, talk about obsessive compulsive. I would just on a whim make a decision. And my roommate in college got engaged. So then I decided I should be engaged too. So I met this guy on Easter weekend, and we got married 5 months later. Of course, I didn't know anything about him. Later realized that he had been discharged from the army on a medical discharge, and had I don't know, today they'd call it manic depressive, but at the time they didn't know what was the matter with him. But you know, then began 18 years of just a roller coaster ride. And you know, I was drinking all through my high school years, but after we got married and he started drinking again, I realized one of us had to know what was going on. So I stopped drinking cold turkey and went back to my old buddy food, and then started the roller coaster ride. We had four daughters in a very short period of time. And you know, the next 18 years were just a nightmare. And I had turned away from my church after, you know, they had told me, oh, God never gives you more than you can handle. And I didn't believe that. So I said, I'm not coming back to church. And so I was in my 30s and had started going to open AA and Al-Anon meetings. And as I read that big book. I was looking for my husband in the book, but all I could see was myself. And I could see, the person who thought they were the director of the play, and if everybody would just stand their places, life would be great. And I thought, well, if I ran the zoo, we wouldn't have it like it is. However, I was as crazy as a bed bug. I had been in Al-Anon almost 8 years, and this was in summer of 1974. And I started going to a different Al-Anon group, and that group said, "We don't want to hear about your husband. We don't want to hear about your kids. We don't want to hear about your problems. We want to hear about you, what's going on with you." And I couldn't identify a single feeling because with all the eating, I would stuff every feeling that ever came around. So I had no idea what I felt. Anyway, then I really started working hard with a sponsor and got up to my fourth and fifth step. And I went on a retreat to do my fourth and fifth step, which I made a decision that weekend I was going to give my fifth step away. And I asked the retreat leader if he would listen to my fifth step. And I said, the people in our group keep telling me they love me and God loves me. And I said, I might be able to feel that up in my head, but I surely can't feel it in here. I just feel like I've made such a mess of my life that there's no way that God could ever forgive me or love me. And he looked me in the eye and he said, "Lady, did it ever cross your mind that maybe you're setting yourself up above God?" And just the way he said it was just like a lightning bolt. And it just touched me. And I knew that it was my pride and arrogance. And, how could I say that a forgiving and loving God could love and forgive everybody but not me? I mean, that is pure arrogance. And at that point, I felt the touch of my higher power, and I made up my mind that I was going to turn my will and my whole life over to God, and I was going to let go. The only thing I didn't turn over was my food. Instead, I went right back to my old WW, and I think it was about the eighth time. And I was doing really well that spring. And along comes Easter, and I came home from work early, and we were going to dye Easter eggs. And there was a bowl of jelly beans sitting on the counter. And I thought, "You've been so good. Just one jelly bean won't hurt you." And I started with that one, and it turned into a sugar blackout. The whole weekend was just lost to me. I woke up on Monday morning and I landed on my knees next to the bed and I said, "God, help me. I can't do this myself. You have to send me somebody." Now, I lived out in a little town about 40 miles north of Milwaukee, and we didn't have any meeting out there. But the year before, my cousin had stopped by the house, and he knew I was always, working on my weight, trying to get my weight down. And I would, but at that point I was over 260 pounds, and I was just putting on weight by the bushel. But he had brought me a starter kit. He wrote to Dear Abby in the newspaper, and somebody sent him a starter kit for OA. And I looked at it and I said, "Oh, this is just like my other meeting. I don't have time to go another meeting. I'm just going to, I'll look this over and then I'll just work it myself." So that morning, I said, "God, send me somebody." And a little light went on and said, "You're somebody. Now do something." And I got that starter kit down and I put an article in the newspaper. I called the hospital to see if we could have a room for a meeting. And the following week, on Wednesday night, 54 people showed up. So that was my start in OA, the blind leading the blind. And, in 1975, we did not have any, OA did not have any of their own literature. I had several pamphlets. I had three sheets, a gray sheet, an orange sheet, and a blue sheet for food plans. I had a pamphlet that says, "Before you take that first compulsive bite, and if God spoke to away," and 15 questions. So I made four copies of those, and we struggled by with the information that I had, and we weren't doing very well, although we did devise a plan because there were no sponsors. We took a basket and everybody put their name in, and then we pass it around, and whoever name you got, that was your food buddy for the week. So that's how we started out, picking a food plan and then working with another person. But one of the ladies said, in Milwaukee they have something called an intergroup. She said, maybe we ought to go and take a look at that. So I'm so grateful for that person that they were willing to do it. So we went in, and then I found out all of the traditions that we had been breaking. And I learned, I started to learn. But most of my learning during those early years was kind of by osmosis. And that you can't just hang around this program and recover. You have to be immersed in the program if you're going to really recover. But I had been struck abstinent, that first day, and I would go to places that they had speaker meetings, and then we'd have some of the circuit speakers would come from California and Texas and Canada, New York. They periodically would come around to some of our weekend workshops. So I gleaned most of my information between the big book and listening to these speakers, because when somebody else would share what they felt, I started to understand what I was feeling. They always say, when you stop eating, you'll know what you'll feel much better. You'll feel anger better. You'll feel hurt better. You'll feel envy and those things. You'll feel them all much better than you did before. And that is very true, because I couldn't recognize any feelings before I came to OA and started to. If you put down the food, then you'll learn what's going on inside you. But so I'm not going to go year by year, because like I said, I was abstinent, and in the first year I lost 100 pounds, and I was really focusing on the physical, not so much on the spiritual and emotional. And of course I got divorced. The first year that I was in program, I got divorced because I finally had enough courage to get out of that marriage, where I had three times they had paid lawyers to try to get out of the marriage, but I just couldn't do it. And then I started, they always say, at the point that you started eating, when you start recovering, you're going to start out at the age that you started eating. So I had started eating as like a drug when I was about 5 years old. So the first years I was kind of like a kid, and then the next 4 or 5 years I was like a teenager, and my girls were teenagers by that time, and they're waiting up at night for waiting for mom to come home. So I really was I would say not operating on all cylinders. But after about 10 years in program, I had remarried, and here I married another recovering alcoholic, only he didn't stay recovering. Once we were married, the first, I think it was on our first anniversary, he had started drinking again. But I only stayed in 4 years that time. So, but during that time, I had a relapse, and I really started working on my emotional and spiritual side, and took a very close look at. I had a lot of blackouts from when I was a child, and all these things started to surface, and I began to see myself more clearly, because up until that time, I really had no idea who I was or what I was all about, or what my higher power had in store for me. I just kept stumbling from one dilemma to another. I just lived from crisis to crisis. And so and then the next 10 years or so, I really focused on my program. By that time, we had our OA 12 and 12, or actually only had our OA 12. The 12 steps came first, and I always got a charge out of it that only a compulsive eater would make a book that looked just like a big Hershey bar. I mean, how ridiculous is that? But anyway, it was good, and it was really good to read the literature better. And I would go to a lot of retreats, and we started studying the doctor's opinion, and I recognized, that how allergic I was, that obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body. I think starting out, I just thought that if I eat the way I was taught in, I was a nutrition major in college, and so I knew how many calories was in everything, but I didn't really understand that even a little bit of my alcoholic foods would set the machinery in motion. That if my cells got just a taste of that sweet or salty or that crunchy, that it would keep crying for it. So the only way that I could really remain abstinent and have the obsession removed was to get rid of those foods, to really keep them out of my food plan entirely. And that was a big breakthrough for me when I really took that seriously, that it was, that an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind, and had to work really hard with a sponsor to recognize, okay, which are those trigger foods? Which are the ones that I can't have around? There are some foods I can eat if I'm at a restaurant or at somebody else's function or whatever, but I certainly would never have them in my house. So I took that very seriously, and really spent a lot of time, and I really stayed out of relationships for quite a number of years, but I was still hanging out at the AA club all the time, and it seemed like every person I met, every man I met was a recovering alcoholic. And I just thought, I'd really like to get to know somebody normal, if there is such a thing, if there's anybody that's really normal. But I did. I ran into a man whose wife had walked out on him, and she was an alcoholic, and we started spending some time together, and he was very different than anybody else I had ever met. And in 1989, I started dating this guy very quietly, calmly, slowly. And he introduced me, to a body of believers that really rung true with me, and I really got quite involved with that church. And it was just a wonderful time of spiritual growth for me. And so we eventually got married, and I am so grateful that I had been given another chance at trying to have a healthy relationship. And we were together 27 years, and 6.5 years ago, he fell down the basement stairs and cracked his head open, and he didn't make it. He made it till the next day, but and I thought, I don't think I can ever live alone. I had never really been alone, even when I wasn't married, I had at least one of my kids was still living with me at from time to time. But it's been very amazing because the people in my OA family came together and walked me through that time of grief, and it was wonderful. It was wonderful to know that that I was okay and that my higher power was right there with me every hour of the day. It was just a beautiful time of growth. And I'm 85 now, and I feel more alive and healthier than I did when I was 35. But I did learn, and after I had gotten married in 1991, everything was perfect in our life, right? But what did I do? I stopped going to as many meetings. I stopped, just my focus was no longer that abstinence was my priority. I thought that I was normal. And I started slipping and sliding. And that lasted a few years. And it was my 22nd OA birthday, which I always went to a meeting on Sunday night. That's all I was going. One meeting a week, no sponsor, no service. You can't get by on one meeting a week with nothing else. And they always celebrated recovery birthdays, and I was too ashamed to raise my hand. But then on the way home, I was crying, and I said, "God help me. You got to send me somebody because I can't do this myself." And the next day, a friend stopped at the house and she said, "They're starting a hall meeting on the south side tomorrow night. Would you like to come with me?" And I thought, what do I have to lose? 60 pounds I had put back on. And I said, sure, I'll come. And I just heard such a different perspective on the program. And they had all kinds of, these are suggestions, but we strongly suggest that you get a sponsor. We strongly suggest that you write out your food, that you see a nutritionist. We strongly suggest that you make four phone calls a day. So, it was more disciplined and structured. And I got a sponsor that night, and I called her the next morning. She said, "Call me at 7 o'clock." So I got to work, and it was 10:02, and I called her, and she said, "Oh, Judy," she said, "I said 7 o'clock. I got somebody else on the phone right now." So I knew that when she said 7 o'clock, it was 7 o'clock, not 10 after, it was at 7 o'clock. And I'm still working with her today. And I jumped into that program and went through all of the questions, and I went through every bit of it through the with the big book and with the tw OA 12 and 12, and doing this workbook and answering questions, and just really plunging into the program. And I've been committed to being abstinent from that day forward, that my abstinence maybe hasn't always been 100%, but my commitment to be abstinent that day has been there every single day. And today it is just, this is the only day that counts, this 24 hours. And if I'm abstinent, then everything else will fall into place. So I haven't been paying attention to my time. I got some time left, right? About
Yes.
10 minutes? Okay. So I'd like to concentrate a little bit on the principles that are contained in the steps. And step one is honesty. And I realized how I said I was always cash register honest, but I was very emotionally dishonest with myself, with other people. I didn't I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I had all kinds of, hang-ups about that kind of stuff. So I said it wasn't the things that I did that were so awful, but the things that I didn't do, the things that I avoided, and the little pushing the edges, like if the speed limit is 65, then I'm going to drive 70. No, that's and I'm not 100% on that yet, but it just rang true that not only with my food, but it with my emotions, with everything else, I need to be rigorously honest. And then, step two was the hope. And, as long as we keep coming back, we will find, in the big book, it says, if we earnestly seek the face of our higher power, he will reveal himself to us. And I believe that. I really, from that time that I made the commitment back in 1974 on, I never felt again that my higher power wasn't there for me and didn't love me. And I really understood that. But I really learned how to do step three, which is faith, and that is to trust that third step prayer, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me what thou wilt. Relieve me of that bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. And that to me is really giving God control of my life. And, as I go through the day, my prayer is, show me the next right thing to do, and give me the willingness and the ability to do it. And he's never let me down, never, never let me down. And then step four really takes courage. And I've done several four steps, during those different times that I mentioned where I was struggling. I had to really examine my life and discover what was really going on inside of me, what really made me tick, what were my character defects. So recognizing those, and then telling another person everything, not holding anything back. Or the first couple of fourth and fifth steps that I did were pretty surface, but they got deeper, and it was like peeling that onion. And then when you get to six, and boy, I'll tell you, step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. I read that wrong at the beginning, to have God remove. No, it was like, I'm impatient. I'm going to work on patience. I didn't, I still had me and God mixed up. And that is an ongoing thing, but as we, this is a long journey, it is a long journey to recovery. And it takes that daily practice. And when we are ready to have that defect removed, it will be removed, and not until then. And sometimes they will resurface. You think that you're not doing that anymore, and all of a sudden you realize, oh yeah, there I am doing that sort of thing that I said I was never going to do again. So we had courage, and then we had which is integrity, and then we had can't think of the principle for step six, but I know that seven is humility. An eight is self-discipline, and that's where we make that list of persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And when I first came to the 12-step programs and I read through those 12 steps and I said, boy, that's a tall order. And I looked at eight and nine, and I thought, oh, there's two I can skip, but I never hurt anybody. And I really believe that I never hurt anybody because to me that was an awful thing to hurt somebody. But there's more than one way to hurt a person. And then when I did my fourth and fifth step, I realized, how I had hurt my kids because of being emotionally unable to reach out to them. I remember one night one of my daughters was laying on the top bunk crying, and I wanted to go in and put my arms around her, and I could not make myself put my arms around her. And that hurt me. I mean, it really hurt me that I was that emotionally tied up in knots that I couldn't even give my own daughter a hug. And then I realized, with my ex-husband, I had been enabling him. I was a great enabler, and I never gave him the dignity of even being responsible for his own mistakes and for his own behavior. I was constantly running interference. So those are ways that I was hurting people without having any idea. So I knew that I had a make a list of the persons I had harmed, and most of the amends that I've had to make have been in the way of living amends. My when it came to step nine, which is love, then I had made the amends with my ex-husband. I had made amends with a couple of people from my past. And but I had such a resentment towards my father. And I never could quite figure out where that anger came from, why I was so angry with him, even though he ranted and raved and criticized. And, he was an angry man. He really was an angry man from the time I was about 5 years old. And, but I couldn't come around to, forgiveness. So I went on a weekend. It was called a healing weekend, and it was a 12-step thing, but we were doing exercises on forgiveness. And they said, now take the person that you resent, the person you have a hard time forgiving, and picture that person as a four-year-old. And I pictured my dad. He was the second oldest of 10 kids. His father was a town drunk. His mother died at 57 years old. And the straw that broke the camel's back was that grandpa came and moved in with us because my mother and dad bought the house, and he was supposed to live with us the rest of his life. And at that point, all his anger from all those years had built up in him, and that's what made him so angry. And it was, I couldn't, at five, I couldn't understand what happened to my daddy. He's not my same daddy anymore. He's just an angry man. So I pictured him as a four-year-old, and he had to quit school when he was in fourth grade because his mother needed money, so he and his brother had to go work for a farmer. And but he loved to fish. So I pictured him as this little guy skipping school, taking his fish pole, putting on his straw hat, and going down to the river and fishing. And he had a freckled nose, and the people in our village called him Huck, like Huckleberry Finn. So I pictured this daddy of mine as Huckleberry Finn, this little guy. And then they said, and put him in your hand, shrink him down, and then put him in your heart. And by doing that exercise, just gave me such a warm feeling that I never again had an angry thought about my dad. And even though, I was with him at his deathbed, and he had never told me he loved me, but I could tell him I loved him and I meant it. So that was the experience that I had with step nine. And the other one I had with step nine was with my mother. And, I'm sure she suffered a great deal because of the way that, I had these four kids and I was working, and I never knew from one week to the next what we were going to be, what situation we would be. But she and my dad helped a lot, helped us a lot. And she took care of the girls when I was working, and I said, I am so sorry for all the hurt and harm that I did by making bad decisions. And she said, nothing ever hurt me except to see you continue to hurt yourself the way you did. And I could feel that. I could feel that because nothing ever hurt me as much as to see somebody I loved hurting because of their behavior. So those were, the two major experiences that I had with making amends. And step 10 has been just a wonderful perseverance, the one word in my vocabulary that just was not there because I was very impatient and I want to do it now and get it over with. And, the only thing I've been persistent in is coming to OA in 48 years. I never missed one week without at least one meeting. And because once I got here, I knew that this was the only place for me to go. But I started several weeks, years ago, I started working with an accountability partner to make sure that I would do my 10th step at night. So instead of waiting till I'm ready to go to bed and I'm so tired I can't make myself do it, I've been doing it after I finish my dinner meal. And I would, go through the day, and I try to use the vowels, A, E, I, O, U. So A is how was my abstinence? E is how was my exercise? I is what did I do for myself in my recovery? O is what did I do for others? And U is are there any unresolved issues? So I would do that, and then I would do a gratitude list of at least five gratitudes for the day and send that to my accountability partner. And that has made a huge difference in really focusing on today, on this 24 hours. Step 11, I've always, since I turned my will and life over to my higher power, I've had him as a constant companion. I'm kind of like Tibia. I'm kind of talking to him all the time. And, sometimes I don't listen as hard as I should. And, it's, but I can tell, I get a nudge. And I know exactly when I should make a move, when I should, and, when I'm asking for the next right thing, it keeps me from jumping into tomorrow and next week and, 2 weeks from now. And I can make plans, but I certainly do not try to figure out the outcome. I can make plans and then let go. And it always turns out exactly the way that it should. And 12. Well, I guess 12, that's having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So it is the steps that gives us recovery, nothing else. It's the steps that bring us recovery. The tools help us. I mean, the tools help us to work the steps. But we focus on the principles in all of our affairs. So it's not just not just at meetings, not just when I'm on the phone with a sponsee. It's doing service. I've been involved in service almost from the beginning. When I started going to intergroup meeting, I continued, and I've had the pleasure of going to the World Service Convention for 3 years in a row, back in like 2008 to 11, and I'm again currently one of the delegates to World Service. I've been involved in Region 5 several different times. And I don't know, I carry the key, if all else fails, if I make a commitment that I'm going to open the door, I'm going to be at the meeting, right? So I think that doing service is one way to ensure that I'm going to continue doing. And I always say, if I do tomorrow the things that I did today to stay abstinent and stay committed to my program, tomorrow I can be abstinent. And don't know if I have a whole lot of other stuff to talk about, but prayer and meditation. I've never been really good at formal meditation, although I really do enjoy it. Like if I go on a retreat, and I've been involved in quite a few retreats, I really enjoy it then. But I can't say that on a daily basis I do that much meditating, although I do love to go out and commune with nature. And I love to go over to Lake Michigan and sit on the bluffs. And there was a really special spot that I used to go to all the time. And last week, my daughter and I wanted to go there. And I said, I want to take a look at how that bluff looks. And I was amazed because the shoreline has receded so much that the rock that I used to sit on is no longer there. It's and there's a couple of trees uprooted along the bank and stuff. So, things change. But that was always a very special place for me by the water. I love to get to Florida and walk the beaches and do all those things. But as we're getting older, and I've lost a couple of my siblings, and we used to every year the seven of us would with our spouses would all go on vacation to Florida, and we'd rent a big old house and get together. And that was then. We can't do it anymore. My older brother isn't able to drive anymore, and so things change. But one thing that never changes is the fact that I am a compulsive overeater. I will always be a compulsive overeater, but I don't have to eat compulsively. And this is a disease that is cunning, baffling, and powerful. In one of our readings, we say we deal with food. It's cunning, baffling, powerful. It's not the food that's cunning, baffling, powerful. It's the disease of compulsive eating that is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And it whispers lies to us, and it tells us that we're okay when we're not okay. It tempts us. It says, "Oh, well, one little thing isn't going to make a difference." It does. One little thing is what can throw you off for a long time, and going down is a lot faster than climbing back up again. And one of the readings that I had earlier this week talked about the as compulsive eaters, we look for comfort in food. And not only comfort in food, but as a compulsive eater, I look for comfort. I always wanted to be comfortable. Any sign of discomfort would signal eat something. And then it said, but the road to recovery is difficult but rewarding. And I think about, that's that steep path up the hill, and then it will have these little, things that go off in and distance, and then you got to come back and to center, but you're always climbing and crawling and going over rocks and obstacles, stumbling blocks that are in our way. But the rewards that we get by continuing that journey of recovery, that gives us life and purpose. When I was young, I had no idea what was my purpose. What was my purpose? In the 50s, every girls got out of school and got married and had kids and lived happily ever after. Well, that wasn't my story, and I'm so glad that it wasn't, because it was that period of time where I was really struggling to make it from one week to the next week that I really learned how to trust God. And as I look back on it, I could see that never was I without my basic needs. And somehow or other, they were always provided. And that gave me a lot of faith. That gave me a lot of faith that no matter what comes my way, that my higher power will help me to work my way through it. And anyway, I'm very grateful to be able to have rattled on here and told this long story. But thank you so much for asking me. I'm grateful to be with all of you. And with that, I will pass. Thank you.